Good morning, neighbors. This is Long John with the Party Line. We're around from midnight to 5:36 mornings during the week. Monday mornings, we get started about 1, continue through till 5:30, and that means we're around for just about 37 and a half hours every week. During that time, I have the pleasure talking with many interesting people, and the subjects we discuss are sometimes considered by a number of people, possibly 6 out of the 8 listeners, to be offbeat subjects. Tonight, I think
will certainly be of interest to almost anybody. If this is the first time that you've been with us, we've talked on the Party Line with people who claim that they've been to other planets. We've talked to people who claim that they've been to Venus, to Mars. We even had a man recently who claims that he's been to the moon. And, of course, these things are rather wild, unbelievable by some people, and other people send me cards and letters, and they tell me they believe these things. I just sit here in front of this microphone, talk to these people, and I find that the subjects are interesting. Fantastic Universe is a science fiction publication. But the article we're going to be discussing, I have been told by the author, is not fiction. I've read the article. Everybody sitting around the table has read the article. I think it's a very exciting article, one that should be of interest to all of our listeners. The article was written by one of my guests, Ivan T. Sanderson. The article is entitled, Man-Made UFO. The people we have sitting around the table this morning are people that are interested in this particular article. Some of them may agree with Ivan, others may not. We have with us this morning Ivan T. Sanderson, the author of the article that we're going to discuss. Ivan is also an explorer, an eminent zoologist, a radio and TV personality, and he's been active in UFO research for over a quarter of a century. And then we have with us Lester Del Rey. This is a man that I've been trying to get on the program for many months. I don't think Lester is sold on the Party Line, but I'm happy that he was kind enough to join us this morning. Lester Del Rey is the well-known science fiction writer and author of Rockets Through Space and Robots and Changelings. My other guest this morning, Ben Iskowitz, the cybernetician, Hans Stefan Sanderson, editor of Fantastic Universe magazine. And we have two gentlemen who are here with us who may agree or disagree with Ivan T. Sanderson's article. One, a gentleman by the name of Sven Ahman. That's spelled A-H-M-A-N. Mr. Ahman is United States representative of a Swedish newspaper, and he's currently a correspondent to the U.N. He's also an expert on European affairs. And then we have a gentleman with us who is a former officer of the Russian army, and for a time, a prisoner of war in Nazi Germany. Now an American citizen, but an informed person on the matters that we intend to discuss this morning. The gentleman's name, I hope I can handle it, Vyacheslav Zavalishin. That's spelled V-Y-A-C-H-E. S-L-A-V. The last name is spelled Z-A-W-A-L-I-S-C-H-I-N. Would you pronounce that for me, sir?
Right. You're right.
I am right?
Right.
Great. I can go home now. We're also very fortunate to have Jim Runyon with us. Jim is a translator, and Jim is here to translate some of my work. I hope. Now, Ivan, I think first to get this discussion on the road, could you give us first a little idea of what the article is about?
John, I will try to do so. Stefan Sanderson and I, in this magazine, which is basically a science fiction magazine, but has been running a number of serious-minded articles on peculiar subjects over a couple of years now, I think, Stefan, right?
Yes.
We have tried to introduce some thought upon theoretical analysis, I hope logical analysis, of what this mysterious problem is of what is called UFOs, unidentified flying objects in the sky. Actually, I think that name, if I may say so, John, is rather ridiculous. I prefer to call them EMPs, which is extra mundane phenomena. In other words, that there may be things in our sky, or there are alleged to be things in our skies, and have been throughout the ages, which nobody quite knows what they are. We haven't caught one yet. They have not, in other words, as the United States Air Force says, been identified. Now, we have worked along from the beginning, a couple of years ago. We started off with all kinds of crazy ideas of what these things could be. Everybody seems to think there's one kind of thing called a flying saucer, which is an expression which aggravates me very much, in the sky, which is not known. And if only we could get one, the whole problem would be solved. And we started off to try and theorize as to what different kinds of things might be in the sky. Well, to make a long story short, we have worked down through various subjects. Could they be themselves these objects, or some of these objects, living entities? We talked about that, John, on your program a couple of times. Then could they be sort of what I call assorted junk, i.e. bits of old planets that have blown up, planets made of ice, planets made of glass, meteorites and bolides and rains of frogs and fish and all the rest of it. We did that part. Then we came to the next one. Could these things be machines constructed by intelligent entities or objects or living things on other planets going around other suns? Talked about that. And then there was left over a residue, John, of stuff. And there have been a great number of reports of objects in our sky since the end of the last war, which seem to be very material and to behave very nearly like what we call airplanes. They started off with a man called Kenneth Arnold in 1947, I think I'm right in saying, who was asked as a private flyer to go out and search for a downed plane somewhere round about Mount Rainier. How do you pronounce that in America?
Mount
Rainier, good. And he said that he had seen in the sky at that time a number of disc-shaped or lenticular-shaped objects fluttering around, and he tried to describe their motions, and the newspaper people who picked him up, he was unable to describe their particular type of flight, and they asked him, well, how did they go through the air? And he said, well, it's just as if you'd taken a saucer and thrown it across a lake or a pond, and it had sort of get it across the top, and they immediately coined this wonderful phrase, flying saucers. But when we had been over the other various possibilities of things seen in the sky, we ended off with a residue of objects which are reported by many tens of thousands of people, which seem to be material objects, behaved like our own aeroplanes, but rather more so. And we then started to try and dig into the possibility that some of these things, some of them, mind you, not all, but some, could have been constructed on the surface of this Earth recently. In other words, that they are nothing else but a very advanced form of aeroform or plane. And we had various rather wacky ideas about it, but we put them all together and we started digging. And then all of a sudden, I came across a man living in this country who told me, quite out of the blue, for no reason at all, that he was a German. He's now an American citizen. He lived in South America, and that he had worked at a certain aircraft factory outside of Munich, München in Germany, and that he was an engineer, and he had been working, or his job at the end of the war was working on certain kind of engines, and these were rocket engines. And that they were in a very secret part of the plant, and these rocket engines had been installed in a kind of circular plane. And that this plane, this type of plane, had flown. And I asked him, I had never met this gentleman before, and he didn't know I was interested in this subject at all, and it was nothing to do, if you understand, with UFOs or flying saucers. We were talking about something quite different, and it came up. And he said that he had worked on these types of planes, or whatever you like to call them. They were circular. They had, I think, 8 engines going around the outside, and we'd have to get into the discussion description of this later, because I will put a drawing on the table, and John is much better at describing things over the air than I am. And that these planes were not mock-ups. They had actually flown. And he told me further that at the end of the war, they were still making them when the war more or less ended. And to finish up this tale very quickly, just to set the pace here, he said that as the Allies were approaching from the west, we had a lot of tanks and such like, and it was a dry summer, if you remember, and the people in this particular plane plant in southern Germany, they knew, they were instructed by the German army, who simply went away, that the Allies were coming and that they were to stay in their houses and do nothing, because that is the end of a war. And they could see this dust column in the distance as the Allies were coming. And his story was that the German army dissolved or went away, and they were left there on their own. And in due course, the Allies arrived. But in the meantime, a column came from the other side, from the Russian end of the Allies. And they swooped down on this factory, as I get the facts, and if I'm wrong, Stefan will have to correct me, because he's got a better memory than me, and it's all right here documented. This column arrived from the Russian side with ample support, heavy transport empty, and a number of technicians, and they went into this large plant, and they went straight to the particular part where these engines were being constructed, and this alleged aerofoam was being built, and they swooped upon it, and they gathered up all the metallurgists, and they took all the mock-ups and the blueprints they could find. They did not follow with the engineers themselves who were actually doing the construction work. They wanted the metallurgists. They took everything else they could find, and they took each one of the engines that were completed and took parts out of them, and they left a large pile of the rocket tubes for these engines, and there's another story which we'll come to later, and then they went off to the Russian side. Now, that was the first thing we stumbled across. Now, what this article is about this evening is that there's a story, and we have heard these stories through magazines published in Italy, in Venezuela, in the Argentine, and they are stories. But we tried to put them all together. And then we started to get more stories about exactly what the Germans were doing or were not doing at the end of the war, what we found or what we did not find there. And Stefan and I began to discover that they conflict. A number of these reports are completely official. There is a report which John has before him, or will have before him in a moment, it's right here, from the RAF magazine in England, as to what a second go-around found out. Now, let me explain that. At the end of a war, there's a great deal of confusion, and the people rushing about everywhere doing everything and not doing everything. And we sent in our intelligence officers to find out what was going on in these underground factories that the Germans had. And they made certain reports. And then there was a kind of lull. And apparently somebody later on said, we better have a reappraisal of this. What was going on? What is left? And they sent out another crew, an international crew from the West. I do not know, it's not specified in the article what they were, but this article is in the official magazine of the RAF, the Royal Air Force. And it is telling what happened some months after the war had ended. They sent back another crew there to reappraise the thing. And what they say in that article, which I hope we will bring out later on this evening, is kind of alarming. They found out a great deal of these things which are, at least they say now, that a great number of things which in the last 10 years have been rumored and poo-pooed, and on some occasions actually denied officially, they now come out and state were there. Not only that there was the V-1, or buzz bomb, and the V-2, or rocket bomb, but there was the V, and they called them in Germany A, up to 10, and that there were up to a number 100 more on the drafting board. That's what they state in this article. Now, the whole point of this, I've got some gentlemen together here this evening, and we've been talking before, and I've learned a dickens of a lot that I didn't even know when we put together the facts that we have in this article. Rocketry is a very ancient thing, John. The ancient Chinese knew how to fire off a rocket. Abraham Lincoln was greatly disturbed about rocketry. At his time, the British, as I pointed out, were using rockets of a kind, which Lester Del Rey will be able to explain further later. What do you call them, dry powder rockets?
They were solid propellant or powder rockets.
But still, they were rockets, and they the British used them in an attack on Pondicherry in India. All the way through history, there have been rockets. Now, one of our guests this evening has pointed out in some remarks, which Jim Runyon here will read to you later on, I hope, if we have the time, and then we can comment upon them. There was a great deal of rocket development going on in Russia between the wars, World War I and World War II. Now, what, John, is the answer to all of this? How much of these published articles, some of which appear to be official or semi-official, if they're not reprimanded by officiality, if you follow me, are true and which are not true? Have I made my... myself? What we're talking about tonight is, could there be some types of planes or aeroplanes or things that can fly in the air today which were developed... maybe only on the drafting board, maybe in prototype, in Germany at the end of the last war, which had been further developed either by us or the Russians. I don't know of any other people in the world who have the industrial capacity to do it. Are there such things? And if so, when did they first start flying? And are they flying? Are we flying them over each other's territory?
Well, I think I'd like to ask you one question right now, Ivan. Is this a question, or do you have a definite answer to the question yourself?
John, we have no answer, and that's the thing that puzzles me. We have an awful lot of facts which are right lying around here at this table. I think all the gentlemen here know about this. Each one has something to contribute. And I am desperately alarmed. I would like to know what of all this information here is true or could be true, and why can't we get a straight answer out of anybody? Now, I can give you a lot of facts, John, and I hope they will come out after all the...
Well, I hope so, too. We should be able to get a couple of facts out anyway.
John, this is not like a radio show. It's like sitting around and talking. We have been doing a lot of talking before we came up here, as you know we do, all of us, and I'm quite surprised at the number of other facts that have come out. You can draw them out, because around this table, I think there are other people who probably just are taking thought upon the matter and putting in what they know about this study. Maybe we'll get some kind of answer as to whether some allegedly UFOs could actually be aeroplanes constructed on the surface of this earth, and if so, by whom?
What do you think about this, Lester Del Rey?
Well, I think to begin with, we should straighten out this matter of V and A. There were 10 A's, and all of them are accounted for. There was A1, which is an experimental model, only about 3 feet high, which was never flown. Aggregata. Mechanism or test model or whatever you want to translate it. It doesn't translate exactly.
And the V?
V is it translates as vengeance. Vergeltung, that's right. That was the propaganda term, V. A1 was an experimental model. A2 was an experimental model of about the same size which flew. A3 was the first one that they began to shape up with. That came out to about 25 feet in height. Definitely. A4 was V2. But before they built A4, they built A5 as a test model. A6 was on the drafting board only. A7 was... wait a second. I've forgotten what A7 was. But A7, nevertheless, it was an A5 with wings. But it had, however, the same basic fuel system as they were going to use for the A-9. The A-8 was designed but never built, not even in mock-up. They did no work on it at all because they dropped it. A-9 was a winged Z-2. which was using a different fuel, that they were going to mount on the A-10, which was intended solely as the first stage of an A-9. So that the A-9 and A-10 are one combination.
Was it this wing V-2? I went through a photograph of a V-2 with wings. It was a mock-up, and it had space for a suicide pilot to guide it more effectively. Was that it?
No, that was one of the imaginary things. That was a drawing and not a photograph.
Oh, this is a photograph of a mock-up.
I can show you a number of photographs from drawings that look like real things. Well, it might have been a mock-up. Somebody might have made a mock-up. But as far as that goes, we've got mock-ups all over in every studio of a rocket, as far as that goes. Not a working mock-up. Those, however, are the official designations, and those were used for the work done in the straight rocket and flip plot in Peenemünde.
Now, where did the buzz bomb fit into that?
The buzz bomb was produced in another part of Peenemünde by an entirely separate group. The buzz bomb was produced by the Air Force. All the A group, or the V-2 family of weapons, the rockets, were produced by the Army, and they were completely separate.
At Peenemünde?
All at Peenemünde.
Right. Now, what went on? Do you know anything about this? What went on down near München?
Well, they had a number of factories. These were the test and experimental sections in Peenemünde. And in München, I don't know. Nordhausen and so on, they had this huge factory. Now, I'm not too clear on my German geography. I should be, but I'm not. They had factories where they built the parts. Nordhausen, for instance, built practically all of the parts for the V-2. And that was a big thing we found.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Don't look for any absence in those numbers. It's mysterious. And V-7 is the designation that was never used. V-3 was as far as they went in the propaganda thing. That was supposed to represent at one time the Schmetterling, I think it was. I've got a note on it. Yeah, that was supposed to be the Schmetterling, which was a ground-to-air missile.
Well.
And incidentally, if you want the Schmetterling and a Rhinemaiden and the V-2... all have characteristics which mysteriously, when added together, fit into most of this story. If you sort of blur them all, you get a very fine description of many of these things you're talking about, as if somebody confused them all in his mind, working the fact where parts of all were produced.
Well, now, did they, in the A weapon, were there any circular aeroform?
Not except in the sense that all of the rockets, naturally, will look circular from the bottom when they were flying.
Yeah,
No, they were not. They did not have a circular airform because they were carried on their tails, essentially.
I'm going to show you something in a moment.
Well, I tell you, let me take care of a little business, and then we'll be back with our guests of the morning.
We're talking about an article entitled Man-Made UFO. It was written by one of our guests this morning, Ivan T. Sanderson. Just before we took care of the commercials, I think, Ivan, that you wanted to get something out of your briefcase. Is that right?
Yeah, something I seldom do, John. I wanted to show to Lester...
WOR Radio, your station in New York, 710 on the dial.
By this engineer who worked in Germany, who told me this story, which seems to fit into the stories published in these other publications, of the development outside of Munich in southern Germany... by the a subsidiary of the Messerschmitt, was that not right, Stefan? Yes. On behalf of the German Air Force, right? On this occasion?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Of a circular aeroplane having six engines. Look, I'm not an engineer, I'm a zoologist. I got into this thing by the back end. Perhaps you could ask somebody else to describe that drawing, if you could later on, John. Or
how? Do you want to describe that?
I can make a rough attempt. It shows both a side view and a view from the bottom. The side view looks a great deal like a conventional drawing of a saucer, except that it seems to have small tubes sticking out, which apparently are blasting out some kind of a stream of matter, gas, or something like that to keep it going.
Backwards, you mean?
Backwards, yeah. From the bottom, it is roughly circular, with six arms projecting at a slight angle from it outward. At the end of each arm is what might be a small jet, or it might be a rocket. But about halfway from the end of the arm to a circular center is something which is vaguely sketched in and seems to be some type of airfoil.
Flange.
A flange, yes. It looks a great deal like a pinwheel that you see at the 4th of July with six arms. And apparently it's spinning rapidly enough to create some kind of a blur. That is about the best I can describe it. This is very interesting to me because it looks very much the way a Rheintochter or a Rheinmaiden rocket might have looked when seen from the ground. That was a, well, let's see, it was about 25 feet tall. It was a missile which they used to attack planes, or they hoped to, and I believe was made by Messerschmitt, incidentally.
Uh-huh.
It had, at the top, it had four little tiny steering vanes. It did not look at all like this from the side.
Okay.
It then had six guiding vanes sticking out from it. Actually, the rocket tube stuck out between the vanes rather than at the end of the vanes.
Uh-huh.
And then it was a peculiar thing. At the bottom of it, it had its powder charge rather than at the top. But if this didn't have the powder charge, it would look just about the way the Rheinmaiden would have looked.
Did you see the dimensions given on this?
No.
And this is reporting 156 feet in diameter.
Well, I remember a plane that we were working on at McDonald's, which was supposed to carry one man. I was working on the parts that somebody else was, and he reported that it was a 20-man pursuit ship.
A 20-man pursuit ship?
That's what he reported it as. You know why he reported it as that?
For 20 minutes.
There's a very simple reason. We were making far more experimental chairs than they seemed necessary for the plane. We were making them only because we were trying to find a chair the pilot could sit in comfortably. And we made about 20 of them up. So he reported it as a 20-man pursuit ship. These things do get slightly garbled.
Yeah. But the point is here, this fellow told me, he said, now these things were constructed in this manner. He explained that it was a lenticel.
Yeah.
They had tried all the rocket types. But there was nothing to do with the construction work being done in that area. Their project was nothing else but these lenticular forms. And that they had a revolving flange around the outside, and that these motors, jets, rockets, whatever they were mounted on there. In order to stabilize them, they had an additional jet above. Follow me. I suppose we'd have to come back to this saucer business. You take two saucers, put one underneath and one on top. Hmm?
Lens-shaped.
Yeah, lens-shaped, lenticular shape. As I said before, but I don't know if I'm making myself clear. Anyhow, take two saucers, put them together, make a lens, and then running around it is a flange. And the certain number of motors are mounted on that, six in this particular drawing. Then there's one above the back end of the top dish, and another one on the bottom side of the bottom dish, pointing backwards, and that they acted as a counter to the revolvement of the flange, all right, in order to stabilize things, just like a helicopter has to have a little...
Yeah, the torque effect.
A little torque at the back, a little extra propeller to keep it from going around the other way. And that they got their initial push or lift from those two jets, or rockets. He says they're rocket engines, incidentally, those two, to shove it in the air. Then the flange started around, and just the same as if you throw a solid object, you can throw it so far, but if it's spinning, eventually it will go further. Is that right or wrong?
Yeah, I think it's right.
Wrong or right?
I think it's right.
I think it's right. Huh? Well, is it? I mean, I don't know. I'm a zoologist.
Well,
I'm not an engineer.
Who can answer it? It
depends on the shape. If it's absolutely flat, it doesn't make any difference. But if it has a slight bowl, it probably will travel further if it's spinning.
Well, that's exactly precisely what this fellow told me. And he said that once they got it in the air, then they turned on the other rocket, and it got a certain amount of would it be lift or forward propulsion? I do not know. According to the way it's tilted.
Well, it's sort of an acid-did helicopter, of all things, the way it's described, so it might get some lift from its motion, I should say.
Well, would it or would it not? I mean, I say over and over again, I'm not an engineer, I want to know.
You can build a toy that will work that way.
Well, if you can build a toy, perhaps you can go along and
build
a larger one. And that, he continues, that two of these actually flew. Now, here's something else. And is this in the article or not, Stefan? You have to bear me out on this. That one of them went somewhere, either into the Baltic,
over the Baltic.
Yes. Whatever, they were flown over the Baltic.
Yes.
There, I don't understand, because that sounds like Fenimunda, huh?
Mm-hmm.
And that one either went into the Baltic, and I do remember a news report just after the war, of something having been seen going into
the war. The first sighting of a V-2, it was sighted in Sweden originally, and as a matter of fact, they protested it. They protested that one of them got out of control, the V-2, and it made quite an international stink for a while. You remember that?
Yes, but I think it was a little different. What happened was, in that time, during the last period of the war, that various mysterious things seemed to be going on over our air in Sweden. And for a long time, we didn't know what it was. And then the strange thing happened that one of these things landed. And there was great secrecy about it at the time. We didn't get to know much. And I don't think you're right that there was any protest being made, but something much more important happened.
Yeah.
The whole thing, of course, went into pieces when it got into the ground in a place in southern Sweden. But our military people very diligently collected all the bits that they could find, and they packed it all off to England.
You're right.
And the British were able to figure out what it was. And so, although perhaps it didn't help them much, they really were prepared for what was going to happen. They were able to figure out how this thing was functioning. What had happened was simply that this was one projectile that was being tested from Peenemünde, and that had got out of its intended orbit. If orbit is the word for something that doesn't go into outer space, at that time I think it was. Trajectory, if you like. And this is, if I'm not mistaken, it's even mentioned in Churchill's History of the War.
Mm-hmm.
Where he gives credit to Sweden for having helped them in this. This was a V-2.
Yeah.
That is definitely established.
Yeah.
It was not a circular thing.
What was essentially the difference between a V-1 and a V-2? The so-called buzz bomb and the V-2?
Do you know the difference, sir?
I think that I know. One was a jet-propelled thing, and the other thing was a rocket.
So the first rocket engine actually started with a V-2?
No, V-1 you could shoot down, or you could get out that way off.
That's right. Look, I got one on my
V-2,
head.
V-2, if you heard it, then you were safe. Because if it had hit you, you would never have known it. It was so much faster.
Somebody will be calling up in a moment and tell us something's wrong with the transmitter. I'm Stephen Sanders.
Yes, what is interesting at this point, though, is that a number of ufologists, including, of all people, Carl Jung, the Swiss psychoanalyst, talk repeatedly about these things first appearing over Sweden. In his book, which was published earlier this year by Rasha Belag and Zurich, Ein moderner Mythos, Jung says that they began in Sweden. They were first seen, rather, in Sweden, in the form of a sort of projectile. I'm translating while I read this from the Swedish Review of the book. In the form of a certain projectile, a type of projectile which was observed during the war's last period, and which was at that time assumed to come from Russia. Right. This appeared in Mr. Orman's own newspaper, by the way, Dagens Nyheter, in Stockholm.
Well, he looks very surprised.
Well, I'm not responsible for everything that's printed in that paper, and I don't know exactly what this reference is to. Apparently, it is not to the V-2 that Mr. Del Rey spoke about. But it is, if I remember right, true that not during the last period of the war, but after, shortly after, there were observations of some kind of objects that were seen over the Baltic. I cannot say for sure if they were seen actually over Sweden, that were believed to have come from Russian test stations situated in the Baltic, probably somewhere in the what we call the Baltic states, the Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia. It may also be, though, that what Jung is referring to are V2s that did not fall down, which happened only with one, but there were many, or at least several, that, from our later knowledge, we can say, traveled over the Swedish territory.
Ivan?
Yes. May I clear up one point that Ben made, and Iskut made a moment ago, to get that out of the way? First of all, the difference between the V1 and the V2, and then we'll come back to this. If you're on the receiving end, it was very obvious. The V1 was a robot plane.
No, you heard them coming.
Well, it was a robot plane. It's a little airplane with wings, with a warhead on it. And
pulse
it had
jet.
Yes, a pulse jet on top of it, which had vanes in front. That's very important. And you could hear it coming, and it buzzed along. It was a buzz bomb, and the awful bee noise I was making before was just that. If I may digress and be a little bit, getting a little heavy and be a little light, I'd like to tell you a story about the V1, if I may, John. A very good friend of mine was a member of the BBC, which is the broadcasting corporation of, over there. And the BBC building is at the top of the end of Portland Place in London, and they had fire watchers and bomb watchers and everybody else on the roof. And this is a gentleman, a remarkable fellow. He was over here as representative of the BBC for the exchange of information on electromagnetic developments and so on and so on. And the man with a great sense of humor. And he was watching one night for bombs and fires and so on, all the things we did during the war. And there's a parapet on the top of this roof. It's one of the only flat roofs in London. And he was watching there, and all of a sudden one of these buzz bombs came. And it was just before dark, and you could see a sort of flame coming out of the back of them. And before he heard the noise, he saw this thing coming. And to his horror, it was losing altitude and cutting out as they did. And then when they finally cut out, you waited. And then there was this awful smack and a lot of falling bricks later on. Well, this thing was advancing towards him, and it came lower and lower and kept on cutting out. And to his horror, it came right straight for the building. And he ducked, and it passed over the top of the building at about 40 feet, they estimated, by which time they were actually shaking all over. And it went up the street to Regent Park, which is the other end, which is a large park, like our Central Park. And they all turned around and looked. It had missed them. And it suddenly took a neat turn to the right and described a large circle and went all over the east end of London and way back to exactly where it had come from before. But don't forget, these things lost altitude all the time because every time they cut out, they lost a little. And it came straight back again, having made a beautiful circle, right over the BBC. This time they said, well, this is it. I mean, we've done our stuff and the war and heroics and all the rest of it. So they all lay flat on the roof and said, well, goodbye, it's all over. And this time it passed with about 2 foot to spare over the top of the parapet and went up into Regent's Park. And this time it turned left and went sailing off and described a very large circle. And the next thing they saw, it was heading right back from for the third time. And then all of a sudden it cut out and it plunged to the bottom of Regent Street. And one of the most terrifying experiences, I suppose, that any man could have. You don't mind being shot at. But I think Lester is itching here to say something. They had a direction-finding device in them, didn't they? They found their own way. What is that?
They had kind of an idiot device. I've forgotten what it was called, but it did behave just about as idiotically as that sometimes.
It was supposed to go to a point and then sort of blow up and sort of do something.
It was shoddily, cheaply put together.
Very shoddy job, yes. And cheap German goods, my dear. And
wartime
it
goods.
There, and apparently something went wrong with it, stabilized, and it described the circle one way and then the other. Complete figure eight, right over the top of this poor Richard fellow's head. However, to finish this off, the V2 was an entirely different business. That was a rocket. And you did not see it coming because I think if I'm right in saying it was alleged to travel at 3,000 miles an hour on the way down.
It got reached a speed of about 3,600 miles an hour estimated.
36. Well, I was walking up the same street, funny enough, that I was talking about, Portland Place in London. It's a big wide street in broad daylight at the end of the war. And all of a sudden there was a noise. I mean, during the war in the bombardment, you got so fed up with it, you just gave up. But this was a monumental bang. I mean, if the Chinese New Year, you would have absolutely won if you'd had one of those. And he went off right in front of my face over Regent's Park. It was just a blue flash. And you don't have time, you know. I mean, when you're out
shooting at people, you expect these things, but when you're just walking along a nice sunny day, and it was a pitiful sunny day, whammo. And then all of a sudden, all over, and there were great splashes of wet on the sidewalk.
Peroxide.
No.
No?
I understand that as these things came down out of, they'd gone up so high, they iced up to a depth of about a thickness of 2 feet of ice. This is what I was told. I do not know, and you have to correct me. And when they plunge down into the lower atmosphere, the ice contracts, doesn't it, when it gets hotter? And it squeezed the bombs and detonated them. So they, instead of hitting the ground and blowing up and making a great big crater and smashing everything, they blew up about 400 or 500 feet in the air. And then when they blew up, there was still an ice cake around them. And this ice was thrown all over the lot. Well, all I know was that every piece missed me. The house, about six houses on my left just tottered a little bit, and we all looked at each other, and then they just crumbled and sort of sat down. They didn't, you know, they were old houses, they were just bricks piled up. And I seem to have been in between the blast, and nothing happened to me, but there were these ice patches all around. Great, huge splashes, just like you'd, if you sat on the ground, you know, bang like that, and there's sort of V going out from you. And all down the sidewalk and on the pavement and everything with it. And I was completely confused and completely shattered, of course, naturally, for several hours. And I talked to a friend of mine in the RAF, and he said, oh, yes, when they come down, they ice up. And due to the ice compression, instead of exploding when they land, by contact, they detonate in the air. And then this, the remainder of the ice is thrown around. So you never knew when these things were coming. And we had a great joke in London. You'd be sitting having lunch, and all of a sudden, whang, and everything would shake like it. Somebody else blew up a gasometer, you know?
I never heard of that.
Gas meter.
And I heard of an explosion in their main fuel pump where the peroxide just blew up all over, and of course immediately became hot water. But that would be hot, and you'd know it if it hit you.
If it hit you, yeah. Well, thank goodness every piece missed me, but I don't know what it was. But anyhow, to stress my point, V2 is an entirely different job. It was the first practical war rocket, huh? And it just came down out of the blue at 3600, and you
I beg your pardon.
Know what was...
It slowed down. It was only going 1800 miles an hour when it landed.
That's awful fast.
Hans, let me ask you this question.
Yes, sir.
How long have you been interested in this theory of Ivan Sanderson?
Oh, I would say almost from the beginning of our discussion of...
He was originally interested
yeah.
in it. I understand, I may be wrong, and correct me if I am, I understand that some attempts were made to have this German engineer join us this morning.
Yeah.
Is that true?
Yeah.
What is the reason that the German engineer did not join us?
I'm sure I think Ivan would be more qualified than I to answer
Ivan?
That.
Is there any particular reason?
No, I don't think there's anything mysterious about it at all. He has a good job, and he gets a vacation once a year. And I'd asked him if he could be with us, and he said that he would like to be very much, but he did not know what he would be doing with vacation or not. He did get it. I must admit I was a little late, perhaps, in asking him. He said he was very sorry, but he had made his wife, and he had made plans for his vacation. There's nothing mysterious about it, John, at all.
Three men in black suits have visited.
No. Nope. None of that stuff. And I'll tell you something else. I'd like to say this on his behalf. I've known him for a couple of years now. But he told me he was kind enough not only to give me the information in the first place, but I have in front of me here 6 pages written by him of correction of the draft of the article that I wrote, all of which his corrections are incorporated in the article as published. And I asked him, do you mind this being published? And he said, no. He said, when I had the honor of becoming an American citizen, I reported all this to the appropriate authorities. They know all about it. And
he did report it?
Oh, yes. He reported it all.
Did they seem interested in
it? He said they were interested in what he had to say, like everybody else. So there's nothing mysterious about him not being here. I wish he could have been here, because he might have been able to add something, but not much, because he has been very straightforward with me. He told me this story. He came to my house through an entirely different business altogether. Which is my own animal business. I never met him. I didn't even know the lady.
His wife wanted to get rid of a bird.
She wanted to get rid of a bird. And she took a lot of trouble. She got in touch with me over the phone finally, and I invited her to come in, and she brought in the bird, which she was desperately fond of. But she'd had a baby, and the bird was attacked with baby's eyes, because and it peeps all the time, and she'd given it away three times, and the people felt the bird wasn't happy and was going to give it back to her, and she thought we were kind to our animals, and she asked me if I'd like to have the bird. I said I would like to have very much. She brought it in, and she happened to bring a little baby with her and her husband, and we sat around talking, and I was coming up, as a matter of fact, to Long John's program that night to sit in on one of the very early discussions of, this is almost 2 years ago, John.
This was out in Carteret, New Jersey, I think.
That's right, on
flying saucers. You drove out, yes.
And she said, well, oh, you're going to be on the radio, and you're going to be talking about animals. And I said, Smurfit, no, you're going to be talking about flying saucers. And then I regretted that statement. Oh, she said, flying saucers. And I said, look, please, don't think that I believe in all this stuff, but I'm very, very interested and have been for many years. And I do think that there are some things in the sky which have not yet been identified. And then the husband, this engineering question pops in, said, I know there are, because I worked on one of them. And he said, I know that thing was in the sky. And he said, if it was in the sky at the end of the war, and then he explained himself in Germany, he said, I don't see why it shouldn't be in the sky now. Because, after all, the prototype of this and one flying machine, the engines, et cetera, went, certainly, he said, I know that some of these were taken to the Russian side, and he said, I think that some others were brought to this side. And he said, if...
The plans or the craft?
The craft, according to him, went the other way.
What's the other way?
To Russia.
To Russia? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, or to that side. And a certain number of plans and some of the engineers came to this side. And he pointed out, and this is a point that I want to make, John, that if technology had got to that point, if it had, that's what I want to know. I mean, the man may be making this all up, but...
The engineer?
The engineer, yeah. But what he says coincides with what we now find in various other magazines. I mean, there's RAF magazine, there's one from Yugoslavia here, there's another one, quote, by an ex-Wehrmacht officer who has written it in Spanish, and all the rest which we can give you the details of, because I have no memory, but they're all listed here on paper, and we can give them to you if you want them, and I think sooner or later. He may be telling a great story, but what he told at that time, that's 2 years ago, I was very interested. I didn't do anything further except put it on paper. And then when we began to find these other statements which coincided with them, we put the whole thing together, and then we sent him back to this engineer my draft, as I said before. And he sent me these six pages that I have here saying, your memory is mistaken, and he had certain things correct. And what he said was this, that technology had increased to that point in Germany, before the end of the war, and that the results of their researches and their mock-up, and he stresses in this article that they were not just factory models, which as an engineer, I don't know all these terms.
Working models,
that they were not working models, they were actual prototype planes. They flew, two of them, and he said that Hitler inspected one of them and very nearly flew in one of them. That's his story. I don't know. But
how does he know all this?
Because he worked in that factory, he said.
Mm-hmm. Was this a rumor on the part of Hitler, or did he see Hitler at the factory examining this craft?
He was present as a junior engineer at this factory when the big man himself turned out to inspect
this craft. It was Lordhausen.
No, it's not Lordhausen.
In Munich.
Outside of Munich.
Hitler inspected the prototype. The first is...
Was this the Messerschmitt factory?
It's one of the Messerschmitt.
Because right outside Munich, right in the mountains, there are tunnels.
That is the place.
Let Hans read this.
The engineer's own words are, Hitler inspected the prototype. The first two official test flights, not the first plant test, were made in his presence.
And that was outside of Munich. And it was a Messerschmitt subsidiary.
Yeah, well, they definitely are bored into the mountains.
Into the mountains.
There are tunnels that were underground. Well, they weren't really underground. They were inside the mountains. There were tunnels that were Messerschmitt factories.
That's right. That's the old
thing. The Harz Mountains, aren't they?
Right between Munich and Garmisch.
That's right. That's the place that he has in his notes here, which we did not
see. Is it this engineer's belief that this strange appearing craft, this saucer-shaped craft, is flying over the States?
No, he didn't go that far. He's far too pragmatic for that. He simply said, I worked on such a craft in Germany, and I saw it.
fly. And at the end of the war, both Allies arrived simultaneously. And the only remaining machine, one having crashed in the Baltic or just gone out of space, gone out into space, was taken away behind the Iron Curtain, as we call it, plus the metallurgists who worked on the rocket tubes. And they took all the blueprints they could lay their hands on. By agreement, it's all perfectly legal and everything, and they went away. They did not even bother to take the engineers. And they left a large number of these rocket tubes. And here is the point, John, that the tubes themselves are still allegedly lying around there, because when our allies on this side, that is the Western allies, arrived, hours or days, a few days later, I think I'm right in saying, according to his statement, they were interested in anything that flew. And they went around and they couldn't find anything that flew. And a lot of the engineers pointed out to them, well, these rocket tubes to make something fly, they said, we are not interested. Now, they turned around, according to his statement, and they said to the Messerschmitt factory there, to the German management, the civilian management, get back into production, get the economy going again. But don't make anything of a military nature, and don't make anything that flies. Make trucks, make anything you like. And he tells me, this is his story, which is published in there, that the German management went to work to try and get things going, but they did not have any steel, John. They were short of steel. Therefore, they cannibalized anything that they could find in their junk piles or anywhere else. And they started melting down everything. And when they came to these rocket tubes, they were unable to melt the darn things. They tried the very best furnaces that they had, and they had a great deal of trouble. Finally, they did get sufficient heat or whatever it was, and they melted down some of them, I think he says in the article here, to make them into blocks for truck engines. But there were still, when he left, piles of these things lying around, and we, and I say we, the Allies on this side, were totally disinterested. They said, well, it was just a lot of big tubes, and left it at that. I see Lester shaking his head and looking really distressed about this.
You don't agree, Lester?
This was the thing that threw me worst on this testimony of anything.
Right, well, you pull it apart. I'm simply a reporter. I'm a zoologist.
This man is an engineer, but he obviously was not a machinist.
No, he wasn't.
A machinist who could take. We'll assume that they had a metal which is very difficult to melt for them. There are metals such as some alloys, and certainly tungsten wouldn't be melted easily. There are a number of metals which would be very difficult to melt.
These were not pure metals.
Oh, they were, all right. Some kind of an alloy with a very high melting point. Fine. We'll even go that far. But when they will take those unknown metals and start machining them as rare and precious as machining tools were then, not knowing exactly what they are, those men are not machinists, they are geniuses.
They didn't machine them.
He said, it quoted, machine this unknown new material into engine blocks.
No, what he
they
told
did
me,
not.
Which is in here, is that they find it, managed to melt them down.
Will you read it, Hans?
They've managed to melt them down, and from that they got a certain amount of beryllium steel, I think I'm right in saying. Don't you have a steel with beryllium alloy?
Yes.
Right, they got a certain amount of that, which they then tooled and used. Big engine, cheap engine block.
Is there anything in the article about that?
Yes. Were they able to master them and to reshape this mysterious metal into blocks for gasoline engines so badly needed at that time? Well, reshaping unknown metal into blocks is a pretty tricky business. It's sometimes tricky even with known metals.
Well, that's bad writing on my part, because he did not exactly say that. I will, during the coffee break, search through his six pages here and finish down.
Yeah, I'd be interested in that.
They finally melted them down.
Yeah.
And they got some steel out of it. And the steel they used to make cheap engine blocks. Am I not right, Stefan? Stefan?
No, I think that is his word. Well, those are his own words.
What Lester just read?
Yeah.
Oh, they are. Well, I don't know.
I looked through
them.
I don't like that kind of sloppy reporting, because I can't conceive that any practical engineer would risk his very valuable machine tools trying to machine for engine blocks, which are usually, incidentally, plain cast iron.
Mm-hmm.
They don't need steel for that. He would risk his tools on anything that refractory and difficult to operate and unknown.
Mm-hmm.
Because they might just chop his tools all to bits, and besides which, he wouldn't be able to allow for tempering, he wouldn't be able to allow for
expansion and contraction. He wouldn't know how to put them together. It would be very dangerous and difficult stuff
then
to do.
Then I can follow what you're saying. I don't know. Now, this is another question I want to ask.
I think he's probably an honest man, but I think that he has gotten a lot of the scuttlebutt mixed up with things that were happening that he actually was working on.
WOR Radio, 710 on the dial in New York.
Right after when according to the reparations agreement, the Russians were entitled to certain factories. When they did come into parts of Germany and took factories lock, stock, and barrel and shipped them right back to the Soviet Union, they even ripped up stretches of railroad track. I mean, they took anything they can lay their hands on, but it was sort of a lock, stock, and barrel operation. The way you describe it, they walked in and they took parts out, that they were looking for certain things. And also the fact that they actually took metallurgists back and they were not interested in the engineers. The Russian policy with German scientists were completely different from what the United States was. The United States would actually take the scientists, if they were interested in them, back to the States and have them work here, such as the well-known Werner von Braun, who was taken into Mexico for a few weeks and finally set up the nucleus of what later became the Redstone Arsenal. Sure. But the Russians did not use the scientists in any sort of working capacity. They would take them back to Russia and literally brainwash them, get everything they knew. They would, in fact, I think, remember one German scientist saying he spent something like 3 months doing nothing but writing out on paper what he had known.
We did the same at times. Well, not brainwashing,
but then after,
we asked them.
Well, I mean, then just picking their brains, and then when everything was over, they were sent back to Germany. They were never used in a factory.
Oh, no, a lot of them worked in factories. A lot of
that's
them
not
did.
True.
No, except a few top leading stars, such as the man who was Werner von Braun's superior in Germany, is now working for Russia.
Dornberger?
No, I think that's not correct.
No.
What is correct?
They took a number of people back there and had a lot of them work. And some of them, as a matter of fact, it has been indicated, were doing fairly high-level work at one time. They grabbed up quite a number of them along with factories. They very frequently took the men who operated the factories. And they took them back and put them to work. You can call it slave labor. You can call it voluntary. It probably was both.
Say, once again, you know, this is a tough thing to do, but I've got to interrupt and see if I can make a few bucks.
Back with Ivan, or rather, Hans Stefan Sanderson. You mentioned before that you wanted to read something from an RAF publication. Is that right?
Well, Ivan has the RAF magazine. I have a Swedish translation here of an article by Vladimir Shevinsky, which I believe appeared in Look. Isn't that right, Mr. Oman? That you think it... I think it appeared in...
I'm afraid I don't know.
I was told that it had appeared in an American magazine and that it was in Lurk. Anyway, this article describes the experiences of these Russian police officers as they came to Nordhausen, 6 kilometers, and this Vladimir Shevinsky, who is for a Russian officer during the war, who is now an American citizen, says that they spent the first night in Nordhausen. The next morning, they went 6 kilometers north to a village which had the rather curious name of Dora, D-O-R-A, which may have been, I don't know, it's possible that it was this. It was the cement factory there. In the, then, near that cement factory, they found tunnels in the mountains, which were the storehouse for these materials that are described in the article. He and his when they came out of this storehouse, his chauffeur, he says, turned to him and said, this is fantastic. Here the Germans had their most secret weapons, and the Americans leave them for us. There is really nothing evil in these Americans, but they are really a little naive.
That's a quote from that article?
And then the article goes on. It's a little too long to perhaps describe at this point. It goes on to describe how they systematically looted the factory, how they sent everything they could possibly lay their hands on. This is, by the way, confirmed by the RAS article in the RAS magazine. They sent everything they could possibly lay their hands on, human or otherwise, in sealed railway cars to Russia. Let me say one thing, by the way, and I think John will forgive me for saying so. In case any of you are a little confused at what all this has to do with science fiction, we have been running a series of articles on this entire subject of ufology, just as we have similarly been running a series of articles by Lester Del Rey on the subject of satellites and Sputnik, which, like ufology, are subjects of concern and interest to the man in the street, to the intelligent layman who reads magazines such as ours. Unfortunately, I don't think we can entirely close our eyes to the possibility that if the UFOs are not extraterrestrial in origin, as some of our friends say they are, then we have to face the possibility that they may come from somewhere on Earth. Where do they come from?
That's the more paramount
and it's more uncomfortable. It's the more uncomfortable alternative. It's perhaps a little more pleasant and more satisfying, and it appeals to our romantic imagination to say that they come from Mars, from Venus, and complete with beautiful, glamorous suited gals and the like. Mm. But if this is not so, then the question is, from where on Earth do they come? Do they come? Are they locally made artifacts, shall we say, or are they? Do they come from elsewhere?
Yeah, that's fairly obvious. They come from hunger.
That's quite possible.
They suddenly pop up.
And they behave in a very peculiar fashion.
They certainly do, and I'm just puzzled about this whole business from a purely pragmatic and basic point of view.
See, I have a newspaper man on my right. I happen to carry a newspaper mm-hmm. car. We want to know what these things are. You get a lot of serious-minded citizens say they see things in the sky. All right, well, let's cut out all this Venus and Mars stuff and come down to what the ones which appear to be practical are. Everybody shilly-shares and sits around and says, oh, hallucinations and bad liquor and all the other amiable excuses. But there are too many serious-minded flyers. If that wonderful gentleman, Mr. Howell, had not been killed in that plane, he would have been on this program one night. He was one of the most profound skeptics. In fact, he was a professional skeptic until he, in his commercial plane, paid for, look after 40 citizens that were sitting behind him, ran into something which he almost ran into, which really alarmed him. And you should have heard him talk. He's not the only professional pilot I've heard talk.
No.
All right. It's all imagination. If it isn't, what is it? Now, or what are they? I believe that they are extraordinarily varied. There's all kinds of junk floating around, as I said before, but some of them could be developed on this Earth recently.
Well, you get people...
Starting about World War II.
You get people in Brazil, like Simoas, an aviation official and others, a licensed pilot,
who have seen these things.
These are not romantic. These are not easily...
But what about the ex-Wehrmacht officer who published a book in South America?
Yes.
The details of that in that article again. We can't read long extracts from anything, but...
Well, did he come out slightly and say that the German army had these things and had been flown?
Yep.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, confirmed the same thing the engineer said.
And it was an A-7.
All mixed up. Including you, Mr. Lester Del Rey. Now, will you go back to your list of A's?
Yeah.
All right. Now, you run down your A's again.
All right. It's going to be taking some time, though.
No, very quickly. A1.
All right. A1, 2, and 3 were experimental ones developed toward the building of the A4 to find out what they could do. A4 was built, but before they built it, they built A5 as test model for the A4.
Very good. Now, you stop on the A4. I'm quoting now from the RAF magazine, and I have to quote. I'm awful sorry. I'm very bad at reading on the air. They were sent over here, this British group. It was an operation of top speed and utmost secrecy. We left by air from Thamesford, here. The aerodrome which throughout the war had been used for air ferrying of secret agents to and from the continent. and was soon back in Nordhausen. Here we go back to Nordhausen. The date was June the 12th, and we had just 3 weeks before the Russians were due to take over. Now, this is very muddling, because they'd been there already, and they were going back again. A group of SS rocket troops were assembled for our use, and these were given the task of selecting sufficient A4 material to make up 100 complete rockets.
Sure.
There were few complete rockets left at the plant, because the Americans had had the first pick. Did you not say that the A-4 had never flown?
I did not. The A-4 was the V-2. The A-4 was the V-2. I thought the A and the V were two separate lines.
No. V was the propaganda term.
The
vengeance model. That was a propaganda term, and it had nothing to do with where it came from. The A, or the A-series, the Aggregata series, were the ones done by the von Braun group. A1 to 10 were their, the ones they built, the ones they planned, and everything else. They're, in other words, their code numbers for the different designs.
Oh, I see. Now, wait a minute. Von Braun was working in Peenemünde, huh?
Von Braun was the head of the rocket division in Peenemünde. That is the actual working head.
Yeah. And,
So were the V1 groups in Peenemünde. They were the Air Force, however, whereas von Braun was with the Army.
Uh-huh.
And there was as much competition and division among forces there as there is today here.
Yeah. In other words, there were at least two, if not three, separate German rocket developments.
Yes, four.
There were four separate projects going on in Peenemünde. East, north, west, and south, to make it easy to remember.
Yes.
Now, this Nordhausen.
That's completely separate. But that's the factory where a lot of the parts were made.
Well, the parts were made. That's where my engineer said he worked.
Yes, but they made the things for all kinds of things there.
Yes, he said so.
Yeah.
And he said that one of the developments was a circular-type plane.
Yes.
Now, Stefan, somewhere around in all this massive literature that we've had to bring with us, never like to do to a radio program, there is a list of which three were circular aeroforms. Can you remember which that was?
No.
Well, we'll come to that. Let's go on with other...
Well, there was actually a Messerschmitt, a conventional aircraft, a Messerschmitt that had a fan-like wing shape that very much resembled. It wasn't circular plane.
No, that was a plane, which was...
At least the prototype of that kind of thinking was there.
Well, we had one, too, the pancake plane.
Yeah, pancake, but that was simply a plane pushed forward, but it, instead of having wings...
It had really spectacular performance, though, which was
It didn't have a circulating flange around it.
No, neither did the Messerschmitt.
There's an interesting paragraph in Vladimir Shevinsky's article, which I'd like to read at this point. Perhaps it will help to contribute to confusion. while we wandered around in the cavern, I'm translating, by the way, very freely from the Swedish while I'm talking. While we wandered around, the Russian police troops came there to evacuate secret weapons belonged to their department, and they weren't particularly happy to see the regular army people there, you see, there inspecting. Luckily, I was permitted to remain in Dora in order to take care of the transportation of 30 bulldozers, and in this way I had an opportunity to see how the V-2 factory was transported back to Russia. Every machine part, every reserve, every spare part, every piece of raw material, every rocket, complete, whether complete or partially completed, was carefully packed down in crates which were marked USSR to NKVD, security police, you know, in the Volga-Don district. Many of these workers in this factory and the engineers who remain in the Nordhausen area, they were now sent, together with the factory, to Russia. A police major by the name of Jegorov, who was in charge of this evacuation, told that the Americans had left behind a nearly complete collection of blueprints for the V weapons, and in addition to this, some drawings, or again blueprints rather, of the larger rockets, among them the Intercontinental A9 A10.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. They probably did leave blueprints. On the other hand, we had already pulled out 300 tons of V2 parts.
which was sold over here at $1 a page.
No, not parts. We took 300 tons of actual parts, so we got the cream of the crop of those. The Russians didn't quite make it on the V2. We got a little bit better than they did. But I
and parts. Now, Lester, you really don't know what you're talking about on this, and I would like to...
Well, all I have is one Brown's word. I know. All I have is one Brown's word on this, and he was there at the time. He was sitting around, as a matter of fact, cooling his heels while we interviewed him.
Have you read this RAF article?
I don't care about the RAF article. I'd rather take it from direct sources rather than forthright.
I wouldn't. I'm sorry, because I do not understand this chronology at all. I wish to goodness we had the time, while we're talking, somebody to write down a date, 12 months and a year from... 6 months before the war ended, till about a year after it ended, and then see exactly what these people are talking about. Now, these people in the RAF article, they were sent back, in other words, apparently, right at the collapse.
They were the British. The British were having a tough time getting any parts at all.
No, this was a combined operation.
I know, but the British nevertheless were looking for it at the time.
Oh, sure they were, yeah.
It was a combined operation with everybody pulling for himself, as is usual in those cases.
Yes, close. But at the collapse, there's two whole subjects here that I want to get to the bottom of. And I don't know anything about it, frankly, except what I've been told. I put it together, and I want to find out, at the collapse, first of all, what actually happened. And secondly, there was a pauser, as the Dutch say, after that. And then everybody got together and said, good heavens, what's happened? Who's taken what? And then they got together according to this article and that article, and I've heard it before, and you have. And they went back and reappraised this whole thing, mm-hmm. And there was sort of combing operation went on. Now, in this article, it says that von Braun had been contacted in the first part and sort of ignored. You know, I mean, sort of fellow rocket expert and nobody's interested. Then they went back again, and the first time he said, all right, if you really want to talk sense, you chap, I'll talk to you this time. Again, when we have the coffee break, I will try to get to mark these paragraphs and paraphrase them for you, John, because I think it's very important to find out exactly why there was that pauser between the actual collapse and us getting together and sort of saying, well, I mean, von Braun is a very important man, and let him talk. And he says in this article, in quotes, the other idiots who came here, they didn't even ask me any sensible questions. So I just kept my mouth shut.
You know the army system, Ivan. The first thing that happened was that the army went in there. Then the army sent in their engineers, and they regarded as first-class scientists, of course. In the meantime, the people who were interested in rocketry and other scientists were sitting around saying, let us in, we want to talk to these guys. And they said, don't bother us now, we've got a country to occupy.
Uh-huh.
And so, in the meantime, the engineers were saying, what's the use of picking up a man when we can pick up the part?
Yes, that makes sense.
And so there was just one bunch of confusion until the right men could get in there behind the army. And that always takes a long time.
In the meantime, the Russians are very well organized.
The Russians were organized.
Now, we have the gentleman on our left who hasn't said anything yet, and I don't know if we can organize this. John, have you got some business to attend to first?
I think we should take a moment to talk about Hudson Vitamins.